Let's go ahead and begin. I think we're about on time here. Let's open with a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you for this opportunity to be together. Thank you for the opportunity to share one another's stories and burdens and struggles, as well as rejoice in what you are doing through the various teachers and schools and classrooms, the next generations of students, of leaders, of parents who catch the vision, of communities who rally behind schools. And what an encouragement it is to see what's going on throughout the nation and throughout the world. Thank you for enabling us to be a part of it. Thank you for your grace that has made that possible. I pray, Lord, that you would use this time as encouragement, as instruction, and as an opportunity to further understand the glories and the grace that you have given us through your creation and through the arts. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. My name is Greg Wilbur. I'm from Franklin, Tennessee. I've been involved in various facets of classical education on the secondary level, the grammar level, the collegiate level, church music, various odds and ends in aesthetics and literature, the arts, drama, music. I've done a little bit of it all. But it's been mostly recently in the last few years that I've begun to think through the concept of a graded program of music, and also the difficulties that so often we face as music educators to justify our existence. And I know that many of you who are music educators, who fits in as a music educator, a few there, are often a bit battle weary. For some reason, the English teacher does not have to justify their existence, math, etc. But we often do. And not only for parents, but often administration, curriculum committees, boards, etc. And so I recognize that. And I hope this will be an encouragement, as well as perhaps provide ammunition. And maybe they can edit that out. Provide ammunition for when you go home to help give some perspective, a broader perspective of why music is important, how it's important, how it should be reintegrated into the core curriculum of what we're doing. Tolkien, in the Silmarillion, wrote, "Of the theme that I have declared to you, I will now that ye make in harmony together a great music. And since I have kindled you with the flame imperishable, you shall show forth your powers in adorning this theme, each with his own thoughts and devices, if he will. But I will sit and hearken, and be glad that through you great beauty has been awakened into song. Then the voices of the Anur, like unto harps and lutes and pipes and trumpets and viols and organs, and like unto countless choirs singing with words, began to fashion the theme of Iluvatar into a great music. And a sound arose of endless interchanging melodies woven in harmony that passed beyond hearing into the depths and into the heights, and places of the dwelling of Iluvatar were filled to overflowing, and the music and the echo of the music went out into the void, and it was not void." This is Tolkien's writing of the creation of the world. And one of the things that Tolkien understood was the place of music. Tolkien, despite the fact that he was 20th century, was in very many senses pre-modern. And he tapped into what had been known up until the time of the Enlightenment under various guises of the morality of music, of the music of the spheres, of the importance of music, of the place of music in the quadrivium. And he understood that. And he recognized as such, even within his creation narrative, that the order and the structure of the universe is inherently mathematical, is inherently musical, and those two are interrelated, especially in the mathematical realm. Hence, the mathematical side of the quadrivium, in which music is an important and necessary part. I do need to apologize ahead of time. I have way too much material, so we will rush through as much as we can, but giving you a taste of several of these things. The core of early Greek education was physical education and music. It was not until about the 5th century BC that the influence of rhetoric on the liberal arts came to be felt. And so from the very early stages, it was integrated as part of the education of the Greeks. Recognize, too, I should make an apologetic for this. I'm going through the ancients, I'm going through the pagans, and into the medievals, with the understanding that they understood the truth of the morality of music and these various influences, and I'll tie that all together later, so don't let Plato and Aristotle distract you too much there, or Pythagoras, because he can be distracting. Pythagoras, around 600 B.C., legend has it that Pythagoras passed by a smithy, and there were various hammers of different weights at work, and each produced a different tone. And the weights of the various hammers were different and were marked. And he noticed that four of the sounds that were made by the hammers were consonant, and one was dissonant. And so that got him to thinking about the mathematical concept of sound, mathematical concept of music. And he discovered that the ratios, the four consonant ratios, were 2 to 1, 3 to 2, 4 to 3, and 9 to 8. We'll come back to that. But that is the octave, the fifth, the fourth, and the whole step. So the most consonant of the intervals are those that have the simplest ratios. And arriving back home, he verified those with strings. Now, it's hard to verify anything that Pythagoras did as legend or as truth, but nevertheless, the continuation of that that thought through the Pythagoreans or through Pythagoras himself. So he discovered that the various ratios of the length of the string produce these consonant intervals. And so, as I said, the simplest ratios produce the most consonant sounds. For instance, the most dissonant ratio, the most dissonant interval that we have in music is the tritone, which has a ratio of 45 to 32. Not exactly as pretty of a ratio as 3 to 2 or 1 to 2, 2 to 1. So, and what hence it was called by the church in the Middle Ages, Diabolus in Musica, as you well know, the devil in music. And I'm sure we're all taught in musical education classes how silly those medievals were to give some sort of sense of moral judgment on an interval, because it's just notes, right? But you see throughout the history of music various times in which the church has made decisions about what are appropriate uses of intervals, what are appropriate harmonies, because once again they were coming from a basis of moral understanding. And whether those judgments were correct or not, and they did change over time, whether they were correct or not, they were still coming from that perspective. It is through archaeology there have been stringed instruments and wind instruments discovered as far back as 3000 B.C. In the area of Babylon, Sumer, and Egypt, in which the string lengths and the placement of the holes are obvious that they were based upon mathematical proportions. So the concept of math and the understanding of math and the proportions goes back at least beyond Pythagoras, perhaps as far back as 3000 B.C. Pythagoras, his whole theology, philosophy, all is number. In fact, his discovery of musical consonances gave rise to his mathematical philosophy. And he assumed this tie not only in the reality of the music around him, but also in astronomy, arguing that the order of the universe reflected musical and mathematical harmonies, hence the origins of the concept of the music of the spheres, which we'll talk a little bit about more in a minute. And this became the connection of music to the quadrivium. Following Athens' defeat in the Peloponnesian War, music no longer was central to the curriculum, and rhetoric emerged as the cornerstone of education. In the days of Plato and Aristotle, music formed an essential part of the education and was believed to play an important part in the formation of character. You've all seen, probably, the quotes from the Republic, etc., on Plato and Aristotle's concepts on music. Plato's thoughts on music in various of his writings, that music has moral or immoral effects, bad music can corrupt the soul, rhythms can influence the listener. Purpose of music is to lead a well-balanced order in the individual and in the state. Music is described as something which sinks to the depths of the soul and remains there. Music should restore the soul's order, bringing concord by its harmony and rhythms. Sober and ordered music makes a man better, while the vulgar and trivial sort makes him worse. A beautiful melody should be played for children as part of the foundation of their education. There were different modes, the various scales, the Greek scales, the modes were different, suitable for different practical moral action. The Hellenic Dorian mode was a very patriotic mode for Plato. The Lydian or Phrygian modes were considered to be effeminate and were therefore not good modes to use in the instruction of, you know, soldiers. Plato deplored modes that were associated with eroticism. Aristotle divided the sermon of the divine harmony to be bodily senses of sight and hearing, and that's possible because harmony enters into the very constitution of the human body. In Politics, he wrote, "Rhythm and melody supply imitations of anger and gentleness, and also of courage and temperance, and of all the qualities contrary to these, and of all the other qualities of character, which hardly fall short of the actual affections, as we know from our own experience. For in listening to such strains, our souls undergo a change. The habit of feeling pleasure or pain at mere representations is not far removed from the same feelings about realities." And you'll recognize the same thought that he has in Poetics as to the purpose of drama. The catharsis that you see on stage rids the body and the body politic of certain feelings and emotions that therefore they will not act out within the culture, but live through those and they cleanse themselves of those through what goes on stage. He reviews the arguments that that the planets emit sounds. Pythagoras had said that the planets are huge, they're large bodies, they must surely emit a large volume of sound. Aristotle thought that the idea was beautiful and poetic, but absurd. That didn't quite follow his view of natural philosophy, but he thought it was indeed a beautiful and poetic idea. Philo of Alexandria explained that providentially we cannot hear the music of the spheres because, like the song of the sirens, it would induce frenzied longings. And so if we actually heard it, we wouldn't be able to handle it. However, he himself was convinced that Moses heard that music on Mount Sinai. So there was a connection there. Part of the foundation, then, of the Middle Ages comes from the apocryphal writings, the Wisdom of Solomon. "Thou hast ordered all things in measure and number and weight." And the philosophers of antiquity in the Middle Ages were not interested in music and music making as an isolated and idle pastime, but in music's role as part of an integrated and divinely ordered universe. The ordering of all things by measure, number, and weight. And that was one of the influential verses, one of the influential concepts in the life of Bach and the composers that went before him. The idea of that well-ordered and well-measured representation of the universe through music. In the medieval age, Basil echoes Aristotle's criticisms of music of the spheres, and relating to that, Augustine looks at that along with his relationship with Ambrose and Ambrose's writings on music. And in a homily on Psalm 42, Augustine declares that when a man comes close to the very point of death, the mind becomes detached from this world and hears an intellectual music. "A sound from above so strikes in silence, not on the ears but on the mind, that whoever hears that melody is filled with loathing of corporeal sounds and all human life in the ineffable song from heaven." And on Christian teaching, he is certain that music and number are keys to unlock the exegesis of Scripture. Moreover, numbers are governed by immutable rules and are a signpost to the unchanging Creator. Augustine wrote a treatise on music called De Musica, and if you have a copy or you can find a copy, it's mine, give it to me. I will compensate you orally. I cannot find a copy anywhere, but he did write a treatise on music in which he discusses the principles of the harmony in the cosmos. Incidentally, Ptolemy wrote a work on music as well, which I have not been able to track down, so if you find that one too, let me know. Augustine wrote in Confessions, "How I wept at thy hymns and canticles, pierced to the quick by the voices of thy melodious church. Those voices flowed into my ears, and the truth distilled into my heart, and thence there streamed forth a devout emotion, and my tears ran down, and happy was I therein." In the early days of the church fathers had a lot to say that was negative about music, but they were also dealing with the pagan influence of music and the purpose of music, and so the context of how they looked at that is important. But I'll just touch on that and not really get into that. Boethius, around 480, in Vitruvius's 10 books on architecture, he wrote, he helped to transmit the idea that the proportions of a building or of a room would look right to the eye if the dimensions were based on the proportions that rule the art of music. And I'm sure you've heard the quote, I can't remember who said it at this point, but architecture is frozen music. Of course, music being an art that takes place over time, interesting connection, especially with the ideas of Vitruvius and the mathematical proportion. Boethius was concerned that the mathematical disciplines were weak in the Roman studies, that they concentrated more on grammar, logic, and rhetoric to the exclusion of the quadrivium. The harmonies of music, the harmonies of the heavens and the seasons, the binding of the elements by numbers, the connection between earth and fire and air and water and the seasons and how all these things interchange was part of the concern of how they saw the harmony of music, the harmony of society, the harmony of culture, the harmony of the soul within the cosmos as well. He divided music into three categories, musica mundana, the cosmic harmony that holds everything together. Harmonia in Greek has a root meaning of the fitting together of potentially conflicting elements. And so it was the bringing of those things together into a coalesced whole. This is where we get the ideas of the music of the spheres, and we'll talk about that more in a moment. Interestingly, in April of this year, the Royal Astronomical Society released a study stating that the corona of the sun carries sound waves similar to organ pipes or to guitar strings. It's below audible sound, but the acoustic waves are created by explosive events in the sun's surface. The sounds decay to silence in about an hour, and dissipating in the hot sun's corona. So once again, the idea of music of the spheres becomes more relevant. Musica humana, the blending of the soul and the physical body. The primary concords of the octave, the fifth and the fourth, correspond to the soul's threefold power to think, to perceive, and to acquire a skill or habit. Music was bound up with morals and the spiritual life, beginning each day with a prayer sung to chant. One of the things that they discovered after Vatican II, when the singing of psalms and the marking of the hours was removed from various monasteries, is that they dealt with far many more issues and problems within the community. And there were certain monasteries that actually petitioned to start back the singing, the marking of the hours of the day, through the singing of psalms, and were allowed that. And over time, all the negative influences that they'd had to deal with when they stopped singing dissipated. And then musica instrumentalis, lowest on the hierarchy, which is the actual production of music, lyres, pipes, the human voice, etc. But the music of the spheres, this is my father's world, and to my listening ears, all nature sings and round me rings the music of the spheres. That concept was operative throughout the Middle Ages. When we get to the point of the Enlightenment and in the modern world, that's when we begin to see this change with the advent of a more sensual aesthetic to music. The concept of the order, the concept of the mathematical foundations of music dissipate, especially as we make the transition from an ecclesiastical aesthetic to a secular aesthetic. Bach was essentially the last great church composer, because when we look at the accepted line of art music composers, those that followed him primarily wrote for the secular concert stage. And the venue of the church as being the stronghold of the vanguard of the arts was no longer the case, because when you even Handel didn't really write much for the church. He was still writing for the stage. Messiah is not a liturgical work. And there's a difference between that aesthetic. Not that it's not a sacred work. Don't bombard me on that. But there's a different aesthetic there than, say, one of the cantatas that Bach wrote on a weekly basis, which has all the beauty and majesty and ability of Handel's greatest works, but that he was writing on a weekly basis, but for the context of the church. Martin Luther's views on education were greatly influenced by his devotion to music. He believed that teachers who were unable to sing were not worthy of teaching. Take that one back home. just don't tell them where you got it. Luther also felt that schoolboys should be instructed in singing each day after lunch. In this way, he thought that the student's moral, devotional, temperamental, and intellectual disposition would be improved. The story of Bach is interesting also in that in his lifetime, he fought against the removal of music in the curriculum in Leipzig. And that was one of his great struggles when he was there, to the extent that even after he died, within a generation, music was no longer even listed as part of the curriculum for the school there. So the great legacy of music, not only of Bach, but the previous cantors of St. Thomas School, was over, which also directly affected the worship and music of the church, because it was the schoolboys there at St. Thomas School that provided the music for the four area churches. And so it was a direct attack on the worship of the church, and also removal of that influence upon the educational process. Morality of music was no longer as great of a concern post-Enlightenment. Music was freed from numerical control. New sensual appeals were created which changed the focus and the perception of music. And there's a lot that could be said about that in terms of looking at some of Hegel's and Nietzsche's writings even on to the next centuries. Well, I'm through the first point. The place of music then in the core curriculum. Several different areas there. Music is math, music is time, and music is rhetoric. Music is math makes a lot of sense. I'm not sure we often are able to approach it in that way. The simpler the ratio, the greater the consonants. And it's those ratios that form the overtone series. And the beauty of being able to demonstrate these things is that you can actually see how that works. I brought my new toy with me. I've had this for about a week now. So this is a monochord, much like what Pythagoras was doing his work with. Just a simple string. And using mathematical ratios. So the most, can you hear? Mostly. I played it twice. That's a 1-to-1 ratio. Astonishing, isn't it? and that's a unison. There is no more consonant interval than a unison, because it's the same note. So with a 2-to-1 ratio, make sure I'm all measured up here. With a 2-to-1 ratio, you have the octave. And you can play that on a piano keyboard, but some of the magic of it is lost behind the what goes on behind the wood there. You can actually see the mathematical ratio here. The next ratio, 3-to-2, here the fifth, and then 4-to-3. we can actually see how the length of the string, because this is all the physics of how instruments work, and the length of the pipe or the length of the tubing or whatever creates the various notes. But this is the foundation of what Pythagoras came up with, and what becomes the foundation of Western music. Okay, so you know, what's the big deal? Other than it's really fun and cool. Is there a biblical basis? Is there a natural basis for what we call Western music? Is there a reason and an articulated reason that we can say that music works best in this formation? How can we make moral judgments or make absolute statements about the quality of music or the content of music? What are the inherent elements of the music that enable us to do that? And so part of the issue, I think, becomes, you know, where we take for granted the origins of our notes. You know, we take for granted the fact that we've got scales of seven notes, or that we have divided the octave into 12. Obviously, other cultures around the world have not done so. But why? Why is it that even in foreign cultures that have divided the octave differently, that they still appreciate and enjoy Western concert music? Why are Eastern composers writing Eastern-sounding music for Western orchestral combinations? There's something there that inherently relates to how we perceive the universe. But what is that? Especially when you take into consideration that as beautiful as the Pythagorean system can be with its intervals, you start working through the cycle of fifths and to get all the notes, and it doesn't work out exactly. So as beautiful as the ratios and the proportions are, there's a mathematical issue there, the Pythagorean comma, as it's called. That's a whole other discussion. But it makes another interesting concept. How did the Greeks tune their scales? The various methodologies of the music of the spheres, was it based upon the size of the planets, their relative rotational speeds, the color of them based upon the alchemical metal composition? You know, there's all sorts of... There's various methodologies, and each one has their own theory. The frequency of color is very much closely akin to consonant musical frequencies. Is there a true correlation there, or is that coincidental? How do those things work? There's all these things. What is imposed culturally, and what is there inherently? There was a study that was done on the idea of consonants. Is this a derived cultural event, or is this something that's inherent? And what they did is they played various consonant and dissonant melodies. They started with a consonant melody and moved it into a dissonant interval, or they started with a dissonant, moved to a consonant, and they started with college students to see if they could tell the difference when music shifted from consonant to dissonant. And overwhelmingly, they could. So, okay, well, this is interesting, but you know, they're college students. They've still been indoctrinated in the music of the West, and so they moved down to 6-year-olds who had no musical training and much less musical experience, and the results were exactly the same. They still could identify what was pleasing, you know, from a consonant sense, from what was dissonant. I thought, well, okay, 6-year-old, it's still possible. Yeah, with Barney and all that, it's still possible that they've been exposed to Western musical tonality. So they repeated the experiment on 6 to 9 month olds. Obviously, they did not rely upon verbal communication as to when it changed from consonant to dissonant. But they set up an experiment in which the infant, listened to the music, and at the point of where it changed, noted if there was any sort of physical change in the child. And once again, the results were exactly the same. When it moved from consonant to dissonance, the infant, 6 to 9 month old, turned and faced the source of the music because they knew something had changed. And so there's something there between, you know, the natural way that we perceive what is consonant and what we perceive what is dissonant. It's not just enculturated. It's part of the way in which we're wired. Music is rhetoric. This should be the Musica Poetica, not the Poetica Musica. This is the unique German discipline of Baroque music that sought to combine medieval music with Lutheran theology and the principles and devices of rhetoric. There's a whole handbook of these musical devices. Luther regarded music as the most significant discipline of the quadrivium. He wrote, "The music is arranged in four parts. I desire this particularly in the interest of the young people who should and must receive an education in music as well as in the other arts, if we are to wean them away from carnal and lascivious songs and interest them in what is good and wholesome. Only thus will they learn, as they should, to love and appreciate what is intrinsically good." He further wrote, "If I had children and would be able to carry it out, I would insist that they study not only the languages and history, but also singing music and all of mathematics." Music, especially within the Lutheran service, was considered to be a musical sermon. It was considered to enhance and to convey the scriptural text. Music can engender a calm and willing heart, making it receptive for God's word and truth. So as such, you know, pastors were encouraged to learn rhetoric to be able to more effectively preach the word. Musicians adopted a rhetorical practice to make their music do the same. And there's a whole correspondence between rhetorical devices from the oratory point of view and musical devices. Musical rhetoric utilized by Baroque composers to convey certain musical elements to enhance the text, which gives a whole other layer of musical interpretation of what they're doing and how they're doing it from that perspective. We don't think so much of the rhetoric of music in that regard. Appropriately speaking, the rhetoric of music also applies to the poetic representation of how we perform music as well. I'm sure you've all heard a precocious 10, 11, 12-year-old who can play a piece note perfect but has no soul to it. And there are exceptions, but that's probably what we should expect at that time. But when they are able to speak the piece, to make it their own, to add that rhetorical element to it in the way that they present it, not only as in all good rhetoric, not just for the sake of the piece, but for the sake of the audience into which they're playing, because that makes a difference too in how you play a piece, and that's also an appropriate concept of the rhetoric of music. Music also is time. Music is an art that takes dominion over time and sound. Rowan Williams wrote, "If music is the most contemplative of the arts, it is not because it takes us into the timeless, but because it obliges us to rethink time." Jeremy Begbie, in a book called Theology, Music, and Time, wrote, "Musical tones become meaningful, not fundamentally because of the relation to anything to which they might of themselves point, not even other tones, but because they are dynamically and intrinsically interrelated to preceding and coming sounds. This is not an accidental feature of music. It would appear that to belong to the heart of the very way music turns sounds into tones." Music is an art that takes place over time. You can relate the various areas of a painting by, you know, looking back and forth. You can see the totality of that. Music, you cannot. You have to remember what you heard. You have to anticipate what's to come. You have to relate the two of those things. You have to be able to understand the ways in which the melody moves in inversion and retrograde and all those other elements. It's a much more difficult appreciation and a much more difficult skill to learn how to do that. Even when we expose students to good music, more often than not, they don't know how to listen to it. They don't know what they should be listening for. They don't know how to follow those trains of thought. So with regards to With regards to musical pedagogy, then, how do we go about this? One of the things I maintain is that we do the best that we can with the time that we have. More often than not, most music educators that I've spoken with generally have 2 or less hours a week to teach their classes. You cannot teach history, listening skills, theory, music reading skills, sight singing, performance. Yeah, you have to pick and choose. It's difficult. I can rail against that and fight against that and say we need music every day of the week. We do. But I also know that that's going to be a difficult sell, and that's going to take time. And we don't necessarily always see the benefit of how that works in the context of education. So I know that's a hard sell. And there have been multiple studies, obviously, on the effects, the positive effects of music, which ultimately, you know, our foundation needs to be the biblical reason behind why music should be integrated in this way. But I also recognize the fact that most parents are not there, and that what they want to know is, how does this affect the SAT score? And am I child going to miss something in their education if they spend all this time on music and miss out on reading some classic? So this is, I hesitate to even bring these up, but they're fascinating because it just kind of restates that point. So from the psychological, secular, law enforcement side of studies, this is what they confirm. Risk-taking behaviors such as cheating in school, theft, smoking, etc. were greater in teens who listened to heavy metal and rap. Questionnaires revealed differences between teenagers who preferred heavy metal and rap compared to others who did not. They had poorer school grades, more behavioral problems in school, more sexual activity, drug and alcohol use, and arrests. A person did a study of more than 1,000 residents in Rhode Island. They tracked people from birth through the age of 30, checking on the relationship between arrest records of teenagers and the degree of involvement in music. They found that the greater the involvement in music, the lower the arrest record. Teens who had music education were less likely to get into trouble than students who didn't. However, those who also were involved in playing a musical instrument had even fewer brushes with the law. Those who had the most experience, including good sight reading ability, had a negligible arrest record. A Swiss study shows that children who took a curriculum that increased music instruction at the expense of language and mathematics, so they received more music instruction and less math and language instruction, became better at language and reading, and no worse at mathematics than students who had spent more time on these subjects without the additional music instruction. Second grade students who received keyboard training for 4 months scored better than students who received special math help on a test of the student's ability to solve problems involving fractions or deal with proportional problems such as ratios. Evidence suggests that listening to music can facilitate learning to read. Students who receive musical training show greater development in vocabulary, reading, and spelling. One test using Kodai training 5 days a week for 40 minutes a day resulted in students who scored 16 percentage points higher on reading tests than did the control group. Then, of course, there's always the Mozart effect, the concept that listening to Mozart at whatever age creates a brief but significant increase in performance on spatial IQ tests. And that's been somewhat debated, and it has been duplicated and so forth. But the concept is there as well. Because I figure if there's a Mozart effect, there's got to be a Bach effect that's even better and greater. But we need to get beyond essentially a secular humanist perspective of enrichment in music appreciation. This is not just an add-on. This is not just cultural education, but it develops the very way in which we think. It orders the mind. Not to mention that it's beautiful. I was talking to someone, the Days Meld, I think it was this morning, about apologetics of teaching Latin. It's like, you know, we don't need to talk about SAT scores. Latin is beautiful. That should be reason enough. But we were still outcome-based. We still want to know what the end game is. We still want to know how this translates into a good-paying job. And it's not in music, you know. We know that part. But even the very way that we look at music, most often when you look at music curriculums, they explore classical music, inaptly called, as opposed to art music. But it's of the last 300 years. Where is the 1,500 years of the music of the church? Where is the developing of an ecclesiastical aesthetic as opposed to an Enlightenment, post-Enlightenment, secular concert aesthetic? Not that that's necessarily bad, but it's different. You know, where's the discernment between the two? Why do we ignore this whole body of literature, all these composers, to the expense, you know, not developing that as we listen to the other? Even the concept of an orchestra. You know, if you have the opportunity to have an orchestra in the school, you think, wow, they've got a great fine arts program. And I'm not knocking that. Don't misunderstand me on that. But the very fact of having an orchestra generally means, most often means, that you're playing music of the last 250, 300 years. That by its very nature limits once again to that post-Enlightenment, secular concert kind of music. And there's not, like I said, there's not anything wrong with that, but we've done that to the exclusion of all the other. As I said before, because of the frequency of classes, we generally have to choose between performance and theory and history. We are called to worship. God calls us to worship, and we are called to worship skillfully. We need to have discernment. We need to be able to listen critically. We cannot do those things if we don't know what we're singing, or if we only look at music as a vehicle for text. There's a difference. It is not just a vehicle for truth. It is of itself beauty and truth and goodness. In terms of the liberal arts, it's the ultimate interdisciplinary art. Learning, listening, performing, orders the mind, the musical heritage, all those arguments as well. And I would include the necessity for active listening. We are so surrounded by music that we just completely take it for granted. And now that we're into the iPod stage of life, in which everybody has their iPods on most all the time, you know, the soundtrack of your life, there's so much music around us, and we don't even listen to it. It's just there. The idea of actively sitting down and concentrating solely on music, and that partly because it is so easily accessible. You know, the saxophones playing at the gas station over the loudspeakers. There's music in the grocery stores. There's, you know, in the malls. It's everywhere around us. So we don't even pay attention to it anymore. I used to challenge students to turn off the radio in their car, to drive in silence. And it freaked out a few of them. A few of them did do it eventually, I think. But we're just used to having that constant noise. I think we're afraid to be quiet. You know, if it gets too quiet, we might have to actually pay attention to the thoughts in our head. And that can be a scary proposition for some people, depending on what thoughts are running around in their head. So Copeland talks about this in What to Listen For in Music, about the passive listener who just lets the emotional waves of the sound just kind of wash over them, as opposed to those who are actively listening and understanding and appreciating what is going on. And we I think have lost, for the most part, the ability to do that and to convey the ability to do that because of the lack of understanding of music. Chesterton once wrote that music with dinner is an insult both to the cook and to the violinist. We are called to be worshipers, and we need to be raising a next generation who can read and understand music and who can have discernment in that. I think that's vitally important. I could say a lot more about that, but I won't. I live in Franklin, Tennessee, the heart of contemporary Christian music, often referred to as the buckle of the Bible Belt, that whole area. I know so many people who are in the music industry, who make their living in the music industry, who cannot read music. It's astonishing. They can make a very fine living doing that without what we would consider the basic fundamental of music. And what that does is that limits what they're able to do to what they can figure out or what they hear. As a composer, I remember when I was young, the great difference it made when I stopped composing by ear, just sitting down at the piano and playing things over and over and over again, being minimalist before it was cool, to being able to writing things down. And when I wrote things down, to be able to see things, and then to be able to explore that and develop things, and a whole different musical phase, and then just being limited to what I was hearing, and also limited to what I could actually physically play. And that's the majority of how music is created. I'm also concerned about the whole process of the recording industry, how records are made. Talk about the defying of time. I've been in sessions, you know. My wife loves it when I say things like that, you know. The BGV, the what? The background vocals, you know. No, but but music doesn't happen at once anymore. You know, one person is laying down a track. 2 weeks later, somebody else has played a track. I've been in studio situations in which a vocalist is singing the song, and they sing it again and again and again, and they decide that they like this part of this take and this part of this take, and this is really good here except for this one word. And so they go back in and they re-record that one word again and again and again, just splice it all together. And, oh, by the way, the pitch on this was a little off, and so they, you know, mechanically fix that. And you have this product that never existed. There is no coalescence of time. There is no synergy of instrumentalists. It's just this mechanical product. An integrated approach, I believe, and this is, I know, going to be difficult. There's the great ideal of wouldn't it be great if we could do this versus the practical living in our own school situations. But to have a 13-year graded program, or 12-year, depending on kindergarten situation, in which you capitalize on the learning styles, that what you're doing historically and listing-wise is completely integrated with the time periods in which you're studying. So that the history and the literature that they're reading is being reinforced by the arts. That they see the connection between the philosophical and the theological ideas. And they understand the development of liturgy over the centuries. That when there's an integration of the historical and the practical and the theoretical. It's hard to isolate any single one of those things as an individual topic. There's so much interrelation. And move into a simple form analysis in the dialectic years. You've taught them all the basics. Now, what do we do with it? Begin to look at form, simple harmonic analysis, moving hopefully to the point in the rhetoric stage of composition by imitation. Anybody who's done a class in 16th century counterpoint knows that the rules are very rigid. I used to do my 16th century counterpoint homework in the football stands at Alabama. Before the game started, I would get out my little staff paper and write my species counterpoint because it's very rigid. So I don't think it's beyond asking, especially a child who's been brought through solfege, brought through sight reading, brought through historical practice, and understanding the development of these things and understanding the excellence of these things and how beauty itself is an apologetic for the gospel, how beauty is part of the nature and character of God. It is a theological issue. It is not subjective to an age. It is not subjective to people. It is, out of itself, a biblical objective concept and standard. And that would move eventually to, hopefully, the issue of aesthetics and discernment, to be able to make moral judgments. Is this good music? Is this good poetry? I have discussions all the time with students on with regards to literature. What is a classic? You know, why are we reading this book? Is it because everybody else has read it? What is it intrinsically about Robert Louis Stevenson or whomever that makes it a classic? Or is it a classic if you're young and not when you're old? I mean, what are those elements? I mean, there's all sorts of various sub-discussions on that. In The Seven Lamps of Architecture, John Ruskin looks at architecture from a moral and biblical position. In fact, The Seven Lamps refers to the book of Revelation. It says that the morality of a culture can be seen in the architecture of the buildings that they build. We don't think of architecture from a moral perspective. We don't necessarily think of music as a moral perspective. I think most discussions of music wind up being something along the lines of, are the words okay? You know, did they say anything that was objectionable, or what's the concept there? Not, is it beautiful? Is it true? What's the music like? I mean, you can sing beautiful truth, but in such a way that it underlies the very nature and character of the words. You know, God is love, but if you sing it 15 times, you begin to question the vehicle by which you're singing that. I mean, that's there needs to be an understanding of the melding of the artistic element of not just the words, but the music itself. There are all sorts of references to music in the Bible. Music is said to intensify the emotions in Exodus and the Second Kings. It's part of merrymaking, used in war, associated with work, harvesting, digging for water, other occupations, used for prophesying, for soothing the troubled mind, one of the early uses of music therapy, David and King Saul. Again and again, instances of the use of music and the understanding of the moral perspective of that. But we don't tend to ask those questions, and we need to lead our students through that. We need to lead ourselves through that first. I think we're the most of us the product of a generation, the first generation that doesn't understand these things. You know, you look at Copeland's What to Listen For in Music, and I think the general person out there has no idea what he's talking about, because he assumes, writing in the 30s, he assumes a certain level of more of musical knowledge that we just don't have culturally anymore. When my parents were growing up and going to public high school, they were required to take chorus as part of public education. So they had a background, at least had a foundation in some of those things. But we can't assume that anymore. How do we teach people who know nothing about music how to listen? How do we begin to reclaim that? Can music be moral or immoral? Or is it outside the domain of ethics? Are musical compositions subject to objective moral evaluations? What is truly beautiful and good, and what is not? What is the biblical basis, if any, for how the elements of music come together? I had someone question me on that about a year ago, saying, "You know, is there a biblical foundation for the way in which we structure our music?" I thought, that is an excellent question. I don't know. I mean, yes, there is. I just don't know what it is. You know, get back to me on that. And that we don't tend to even go that way. We have this assumption of what we've been given, and I think when we fight about issues of music, we fight about the wrong things. We're fighting about surface issues. Or when we're trying to justify our music program, our music department, or what we want to be able to do, we wind up not being able to do that because we're lacking, once again, I think, that foundation that carries that argument. Bach said, "The aim and final end of all music should be none other than the glory of God and the refreshment of the soul," which is a beautiful quote. But how do we apply that? How do we look at music, and what is good music, and how does it indeed refresh the soul? Confucius said, it's hard to say that without saying Confucius say. Okay. This is a little bit large for a fortune cookie, but music has definite moral consequences. And by the way, why are there never any bad fortune cookies? You know, there's never anything like all will be well if you make it to midnight or anything. There are. Okay. Music can make or break a society by being lewd, effeminate, or haughty, thus undermining character. Certain harmonious sounds lead to piety and peacefulness of character. Rituals reflect the order of the universe because in some way they represent the heavens above. how I wish a Christian worship apologist had said that rituals reflect the order of the universe because in some way they represent the heavens above, as opposed to Confucius. The ancient Greeks understood the power of music. Confucius understood the morality of music. The church fathers did. The medieval scholars believed in the power of music in society and over morals. They understood the ordering of the universe. They understood how, even if the music of the spheres was just a beautiful and poetic idea, it was a beautiful and poetic idea that influenced countless generations of musicians and philosophers and authors, that it was part of the very culture in which they were breathing. And as such, it's whether true or not, in the sense of true or not, that it is a valid and interesting foundation to why they did what they did and how they went about it. The Enlightenment honored concepts of individuality and originality. Originality is not a biblical concept because originality seeks to exalt the individual by doing something new that stands out, that denies what has been done in the past, and that gets noticed. More often than not, that which is noticed is shocking, and that challenges the very basis of morals. As such, original art is disposable because it is always being replaced by the next newest original art, and as such, it is also consumer-based. It intentionally has a short lifespan for the sake of consumerism. A biblical artist seeks to exalt God by bringing harmony and dominion to creation in a manner that builds on what has been done in the past and that edifies and reinforces theological truth in the hearts and minds of believers and provides a touchstone of transcendence for unbelievers searching for meaning. Unbelievers receive an incomplete and contradictory image of the church and God when what they see is the same as the rest of the world. The greatest witness to a watching and thirsty world is something that looks different from the rest of the world because it is itself opposed to the world in the flesh. The gospel of Christ and all its truth, goodness, and beauty. I think one of the greatest apologetics for music is that it fulfills the cultural mandate. It is taking dominion over sound. It is taking dominion over time. As much as planting a garden and tilling the earth takes dominion over the earth, the arts take dominion over color, over sound, over movement, over time itself. Lewis writes in The Magician's Nephew, "In the darkness, something was beginning happening at last. A voice had begun to sing. It was very far away, and Diggory found it hard to decide from what direction it was coming. Sometimes it seemed to come from all directions at once. Sometimes he almost thought it was coming out of the earth beneath him. Its lowest notes were deep enough to be the voice of the earth herself. There were no words, it was hardly even a tune, but it was, beyond comparison, the most beautiful noise he had ever heard. It was so beautiful he could hardly bear it. Then two wonders happened at the same moment. One was that the voice was suddenly joined by other voices, more voices than you could possibly count. They were in harmony with it, but far higher up the scale, cold, tingling, silvery voices. The second wonder was that the blackness overhead, all at once, was blazing with stars. You would have felt quite certain that it was the stars themselves who were singing, and that it was the first voice, the deep one, which had made them appear and made them to sing." Lewis understood, Tolkien understood, and the beauty of creation, the harmony that God has created within the world. I know this is not necessarily the most practical of instruction in terms of what you can take back to your classroom. What I hope to do, which I hope I've done, is encourage you to fight the good fight, persevere, keep talking to your board and curriculum committee, make music central to what you're doing, but to begin to maybe even open up our discussion into a broader realm of why this is so important and why this is essential, not only to ourselves, but to the next generation of the students that we are raising. We are out of time, but I'll be around for questions, and I'll be at the Standfast booth if you have any questions. Thanks so much for coming.